home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Good evening, good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio. I am Rob Watson, and in a surprise guest appearance, guess who we actually have on tonight? I think that's Garrett Miller.
It's Garrett Miller.
Whoa. This is a last-minute development. I'm so thrilled to have you on, hear your voice again. And I also want to bring on immediately Brody Levesque, who is our star journalist, who has joined us tonight. And we're going to be talking all things Trump. Good evening, Brody.
Good evening, Rob. Good evening, Garrett. Long time no talk to.
Hey, Brody. Yeah, no talk to you. It's great to hear your voice.
I wasn't sure that had actually ever happened, that I had had you both on at the same time. So,
It has been a minute.
I feel like somebody who's been cheating, and now the two partners are in the room at the same time. It's like
that would not be the first time.
Yeah, Garrett coming on is a little bit bittersweet because it's kind of a farewell, because I officially took over the Rated LGBT platform tonight, and
mm-hmm.
Garrett is pursuing a lot of other things. Garrett, what's going on in the studio for you next week?
Well, I've got. I mean, Rob, you and I know I love doing the show. And about a year and a half ago, I had to do this thing called getting a job to pay the rent on the first every month. And I could never schedule a night off. I had to work nights. And so Thursday night was kind of blown out of the water. And that's when you graciously stepped in and have been doing such an outstanding job. And, you and I have been chatting offline. And as much as I want to try to do the show, this is a rare night off for me on a Thursday night, because I'm always working and can't even, listen in until the rebroadcast. And so you invited me on to talk about some stuff. And one of the things I'm super excited about is next week I'm going into the recording studio, and I'm going to be singing a new song that the music's been written. I wrote the lyrics, and it's a song called Destiny. It's for a new animated TV program that's going to be coming out. And they said, we want you to go in and write the song. We want you to tell a story, and we want you to sing it. So just make it happen. And so I'm super excited to be able to do that and, share a brand new song for 2018 with the world very, very quickly.
That's so exciting, because I love your music. If I was listening to it on the old vinyl, it would have been worn out eons ago. Brody, I don't know if you're familiar with Garrett's work. He has put out an EP a few years ago, and then a full album, I guess it was a year and a half ago, Garrett, the Blonde Jesus album.
Yeah, just about. And don't laugh when I tell you this, but there's still one indie radio station that's playing it, and Gay Wedding is still number one on their chart for California's pop radio for, the 22nd week in a row or something like that. And that's as of this week. So it's absolutely crazy. The songs have continued to have a life of their own, and they're going to be a nice little momentum into the new project I'll be working on this year.
Well, I can't wait, and we'll have to have you back on the radio shows to promote once that work is done. Also, in the studio, we're going to have some new opening credits on this show.
Yeah.
So, keeping your great announcer voice, and Brody has been hard at work producing a lot of our stuff, getting on a lot of fantastic guests, and we're going to talk a little bit in retrospect about what we've been doing this year tonight, the people we've talked to, the events that have happened, the disaster that is known as Trump. Little debriefing. And Brody, you're working on an article. I haven't seen the final on it. I don't know if I missed it, but you are coming out with an end of your article, I believe. Is that correct?
That is correct. The piece actually is still in rough copy form. I've been doing a series of interviews, including Alicia Brooks, who is the director of outreach for the Southern Poverty Law Center. She and I had a long conversation this afternoon, wrapping up a lot of the year's events and the things that have been going on. The Southern Poverty Law Center, as you know, has been heavily invested along with the American Civil Liberties Union and other progressive advocacy legal groups as they have approached the problems that have been created not only just by this administration, but the effects of the administration and, if you will, the license that this administration has given to elements of society and culture that, quite frankly, the American Republic hasn't seen in the better part of 4 or 5 decades. So we had a nice conversation about that. I want to give a quick shout out to our intrepid panelists who are listening tonight. I know they're listening for a fact. Journalist Dawn Ennis, who is a superb longtime reporter. She started off working broadcast and now does print. Dawn's a friend, and I always very much appreciate her and her input. My old friend Karen Oakham, the news editor for the Los Angeles Blade. Karen and I have known each other for a while, and Karen is just an absolute joy. And some of the people that contribute behind the scenes, Dan Avery from New Next Now, Logo Television, MTV Networks. I'd also like to thank Zach Ford at Think Progress, Matt Thorne at OutServe, S-E-L-M, and, of course, Shannon Minter at the National Center for Lesbian Rights. And I would like to thank all of the guests that have appeared on the show that have been so gracious to spend their time. We've had congressmen, we've had editors, we've had activists, we've had attorneys, and this is now a time for me as a producer to appropriately thank their contributions and the fact that we had some wonderful shows. And a special shout out to the one person who always makes me smile no matter what, my dirty little grandma from Whiting, New Jersey, Julia Scotty. Julia, I know you're listening. Thank you so much for all you do, not only with the humor, but keeping me sane as well. Rob?
Yeah, you're forgetting the artists. We've had some incredible artists on, dancers, singers, you know, that I've interviewed that you brought in. I mean, it's
I'm terrible. I remember the political types. It's Garrett, you've kind of missed out because you've had to kind of skip on some of these, but we've had some extremely talented young people. Arcadian Broad, who is the newly named artist in residence of the Orlando Ballet Company and School in Orlando, Florida, which is a pretty big deal because he's only 21 years old. And it's the first time in the 40-year history of the Ballet Company, which is an award-winning ballet company, that they've named an artist in residence. We had a country and western musician who happens to be trans, but he's just an amazing human being, Jamie Wilson. He was the winner of the Spirit of Matthew Award that's given annually by the Matthew Shepard Foundation, which reminds me, a shout-out to our friends at Matthew Shepard for coming on and discussing things with us. And Rob's right. I have a tendency at I just get so busy as we just go along that Rob is more or less the gatekeeper, Garrett, and he's the one that kind of keeps track of this. I have a tendency to have laser focus on what are we doing this week. So there you
well,
go.
Well, it's you know, it's funny because the you know as people as listeners know that I do two shows. I do Out in Santa Cruz and do Rated LGBT Radio. And we've kind of shifted a little bit in tone on both shows. Originally, I was doing Out in Santa Cruz with Steph Miller. Steph Taylor. Oh, my God. See, Garrett, you're so integrated into me. I was like.
There we go. Yeah.
I know, really. Steph Taylor. Steph was very heavy-duty activist, political type. She and I did kind of really activist type theme shows predominantly. She left that show. I kind of broadened out a little bit at that point. Garrett and I started doing Rated LGBT Radio, and Garrett being the consummate artist and musician and actor and photographer and everything, we brought on a lot of very entertainment heavy people, very, you know, and their projects. Over the course of time, it's because Garrett, as he pointed out, went on to other things, and Brody, you came on, and we became very heavy-duty political. Meanwhile, over and out in Santa Cruz, the brilliant young Bash Yeldon joined me there, and we became kind of a little more culture, art, and entertainment. So the I'm still doing both. It's just the shows have sort of changed tone on both sides. So very excited about what we're doing here. And so, Garrett, your legacy that you started here is, I think, going to go on in a pretty powerful way over the course of the next year.
Well, I'm so excited for you guys. You know, you do such a nice job every week, and it's a quality program. And, you know, when you listen to the other opportunities that are out there, there's such a clear difference in the quality of the guests and the questions and the interviews and the engagement that you guys bring. I'm really proud of both of you for just making this something that's, you know, great for the community.
Well, it's Brody and I go back a ways, and Brody is kind of my mentor in not really radio, more in print. Brody, I submitted some articles to the what was at the time the premier LGBT news magazine, LGBTQ Nation, and Brody and the publisher kind of took a spark to the tone and what I was writing, and gave me pretty much a weekly forum there, and mentored me along there on my blogging voice and my columnist voice, which got also translated over to Huffington Post, Gay Star News, The Next Family, and I ended up doing an editorship at the Goodman Project. And so now we're porting that voice into radio, and I'm getting on Brody's case now for a change, which is kind of fun.
Garrett, that's only because I'm a print journalist, and Dawn is a lot more comfortable in this than I am. Karen and I are both print reporters, and so for us, this is a completely different ball of wax. I'm kind of used to going through my phone book, doing my research, pulling sources together, and then doing an interview, and that's not exactly the way this works in radio, as I'm rapidly learning. Not to also mention that the last minute changes in the news have a rather direct effect on what I'm going to be doing show-wise, and that's happened 3 or 4 times here recently where we had planned one thing and we ended up covering something else because of the news cycle. So it's very much a different animal. I kind of, in a way, now understand how the crew at 30 Rock on Rachel's show have to put up with the never-ending changes and cycles, because we get stuck with the same thing some days. And I will literally call Rob and go, you remember I was talking about we were going to do this for Thursday? Yeah, well, not anymore. We now need to do this, and this is why. So, yeah, it's happened more than once, especially recently. You know, in my defense, I think I speak for the entire Washington Press Corps, but we have gotten very tired of this administration and this White House at 5 o'clock. It used to be 5 o'clock was power down time. Anymore? No, 5 o'clock is like the witching hour for us. So that's kind of where we come from. But it's been a learning curve. It's been an experience. The most important thing for me, and Rob knows this because I don't like talking about myself, and I'm not a celebrity reporter or journalist. That's not me. What I like about this is that we are able to bring people to the show that have an important contribution that they make, not only just to the LGBTQI community, but they make an important contribution to the larger communities out there, such as the Dreamers. We had a young man on who was gay but was also very much a dreamer. So, you know, we have women's issues. We have, you know, issues that have to do with the Black community. So I'm very happy with the fact that we have established a way, and in many ways it's kind of like a disjointed, poor Rob, I'll have to give him credit, he has to herd a bunch of cats in a parade when you get three journalists together. But, you know, it's a little bit of The View with a little bit of Rachel, with a little bit of this and that, and it just seems to be working, although, yeah, we're still banging out sort of the bumps in the road. Rob?
Oh yeah, well we always will be. So it's you know, that's just the nature of the beast. So I want to kind of go back to the year at hand that we are now seeing the end of, although nothing will probably change in the short term moving into the new year on the political landscape. As I was reflecting over it, I was thinking back actually years ago to the Michael Dukakis campaign, and when he was running against George Bush Sr., and George Bush Sr. had just named Dan Quayle as his running mate. And George Dukakis's campaign manager was on TV, and she was like almost giddy because he was so thrilled. And I'm going to paraphrase kind of what she talked about at that time, but she was so thrilled because Dan Quayle was so inept and such an idiot. She didn't call him that, but that was the implication, that by naming him, you know, it was going to now be a slam dunk defeating George Bush Sr., which, of course, didn't happen. And the thing that I kind of cringed at when I heard her at the time was, don't ever think that because you think the person who is on the ticket against you is so bad that you're relieved that they're there, because they're now going to be easy to beat. Because every time that's happened, that person has ended up winning. And that nightmare has then turned into even worse, unfathomable nightmare. And the reason I'm bringing that up, because that reminds me of what happened when Donald Trump started running for president. And there's so many people that were kind of like going, oh, great, this is going to be kind of fun, because then he'll run against a serious Democratic candidate in November and it'll be a slam dunk. And as we know, that didn't happen. So I don't know how you feel about that, Garrett or Brody, but that was kind of what I kind of saw happening as we started 2017.
Well, I think it's a great analogy. You know, you're telling something that happened like 30 years ago, and here we are playing the same thing again, and look exactly what happened. You know, if you read any parts of the news or see any TV or listen to radio, you know the president is not a very popular person. And so, you know, the thing that I always like to remember, every time that I see somebody bitching about what's, you know, going on, 49% of the eligible voters did not vote. And this is why we have the situation we have today. And I'm sure you guys have talked about this a million times. But, you know, for all the bitching and whining that is out there today, I would really like to know, and there's no way for us to know, but I'd really like to know, how many of those people actually voted? How many of those people did anything to make it sure that this did not happen, and did not? And so, you know, here we are stuck with this because 49% of the country chose not to vote.
Well, it goes further than that. The November 2016 of Trump as president of the United States set off reverberations globally across more than just the political spectrum. At home in the United States, Trump has given way to influencing, indeed affirming, those segments of the American populace that are prone to racist, xenophobic, homophobic, transphobic behaviors, encouraging them to publicly utter horrid things and take ugly actions that have not been so nakedly displayed in decades. And if you think
right
about it for a further example, Garrett, I'm going to refer you back to two different time points here. Let's go back 25 years. Annus Horribilis is a Latin phrase. It means horrible year. And the first time the globe got to know that phrase was when Britain's Queen Elizabeth II used it during a televised speech, which marked her 40th anniversary of the accession to the throne of the United Kingdom. Now, at the time, most assumed that she was referring, obviously, to the public divorce and the ensuing scandals associated between her son, the Prince of Wales, Prince Charles, and, of course, the British public's much-beloved Princess Diana. Let me quote the Queen. 1992 is not a year on which I shall look back with undiluted pleasure, she said. In the words of one of my more sympathetic correspondents, it has turned out to be an annus horribilis. I suspect that I am not alone in thinking it. So, indeed, I suspect that there are very few people or institutions unaffected by these last months of worldwide turmoil and uncertainty. You know, not only is that true, my journalistic colleague at the Washington Post, Eugene Robinson, nailed it down. And this is what Eugene said. Many of us began 2017 with the consoling thought that the Trump presidency couldn't be possibly as bad as we feared, and it turned out to be way worse. Yeah, the last time the dynamics of this affected, aside from Her Majesty's observations, which I think she got 2017 right, only she did it 25 years ago. If I could take you both back to 1968, and this was a year of incredible turmoil. Now, I was an extremely young person, but I was very aware at that point. You two were probably at the same point, absorbing all of this. 68, if you'll remember, was the beginning of the Tet Offensive. It was the year that Johnson announced that it was an election year, that he wasn't going to run for the office of president again. In April, we saw Dr. King assassinated in Memphis. And then in June, the horrible events in the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles that cost Senator Robert F. Kennedy of New York his life. And then the summer of 1968, where we saw all of the turmoil in the Democratic Party at those conventions in Chicago and the level of violence. And it was also when we saw the Republicans, for the first time, trot out what they referred to as the Southern Strategy, which was, of course, based on the fact that they picked up a lot of the people who, in a contemporary vein of thought, voted for Judge Roy Moore. It's the same kind of thinking. And it's the same kind of person. So what we're going to see in 2018, looking back at 2017, is I think we're going to see a lot of parallels, minus a presidential election year, to 1968. A lot of people say that this year coming up is going to be a really big deal. I believe that's right, because there have been some positive things that have come out of annus horribilis. For the first time, we have seen a unification in terms of female rights, feminism, and people standing up. And I'm not talking about just the Me Too syndrome. I'm talking about the fact that women are now becoming empowered. The election of this person has empowered them. I think we're also seeing a coalescing of a movement that the American populace has not seen in the four decades or five decades since the late 70s and even before 1968. So there are some things, but it's just looking at it that, makes people wonder, Rob?
Yeah, no, it does. I kind of see a tie into what you were just talking about, though, Brody, and what Garrett brought up originally, is that, of that 49% of people who did not vote, that is actually the untapped voice that we need to bring out. And I think really a lot of that voice is what happened with Roy Moore. It's that, it brought out people that got outraged enough that they actually showed up to vote in an election that they probably would have just not showed up for. And it also, in that case, because it was so extreme and it was in such an extreme location, required some of the people who would have showed up for Roy Moore or the Republican candidate to do the write-in. So that, those factors were definitely there. But to your point, Brody, it's like we have people not only showing up to vote, people showing up to run in elections that before were not. We have women candidates, we have transgender candidates, and they're showing up and they're winning. And that could, in terms of a long-term effect of this annus horribilis, be a huge, huge positive if we can survive the short term. And I think this year is going to be critical because, I know we'd love to win the Senate or the House and all that, but I think it's absolutely critical that the Democrats take over the Senate, because the Senate, and for one reason alone, the Senate is the safety net on the Supreme Court. So that if there are any vacancies this year on the Supreme Court, and the ones that could come up could be crucial to progressive voices, you know, that we have that check in place to make sure that whoever the new people on the Supreme Court don't ruin us for decades and decades moving forward. So I think that's what's ahead of us, in my opinion.
Well, one of the things I think is also going to be kind of important to note here is the fact that the judiciary is a factor in this. And let me bring this into the conversation now. I've had conversations with some of the legal teams who have been working on the trans ban in the military. And as you know, we now have two separate U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, the U.S. Fourth Circuit, the District of Columbia Circuit Court of Appeals. We are waiting on the Ninth Circuit. But so far, we've gotten two very strong opinions coming out of these circuit courts that have ruled against the administration. Now, I need to note that unless the Trump administration takes this to SCOTUS over the course of the weekend at 12:01 on Monday, January 1st, the accessions policy kicks in and it's a new point. So everybody's kind of riding that. But one of the things that has been is that it has been this judicial thing, and everybody is alarmed because of the fact of the less than stellar candidates that the Trump administration has been running through the pipeline. Now, even the Republicans have shot down two or three candidates because, you know, they've had enough. You know, there was one that couldn't even answer questions, and fortunately he withdrew his nomination. But this is a consideration, particularly with the high court. You know, and there's
right.
a lot that factors into this.
Yeah, and that's one of the scary things about this year, that is, you know, we've seen all the high level stuff, which is scary enough. But there are factors here that I think are scary because they're not even in the headlines. They're kind of the behind the scenes stuff. What Trump is doing to the judiciary, to your point, the people who have made it to the headlines and that have gotten notice have been so extremely bad. I mean, shockingly bad. Not just, you know, that they're philosophically bad or that they're, you know, potentially dangerous. All of those are flying under the radar. The ones who are at radar are the ones that are just like they're completely and totally unqualified. And, you know, that's bad enough. But that is absolutely demonstrative of what Trump has done, not just in the judiciary, but across the board in almost every single government department, is loaded up with people who are actually philosophically and shockingly bad and doing, you know, bad things, from education to the EPA to, you know, net neutrality to, you know, all of those different issues. And the one that I'm looking at now as well is where Trump is patting himself on the back. And I think it is to his credit that the stock market is doing extremely well and business is looking extremely good, because Trump's government policies have made those investors excited. But what has happened in the past with excited investors is they create bubbles, and those bubbles pop. And when you have a huge deficit, which the Republicans are driving in our government, which means that we are borrowing more money from who? China. We're going to be owned by China when that eventual investor bubble pops. I mean, I think that even the things that Trump thinks he's doing are good are going to turn out to be a huge cancer in the long run. So that's my outside opinion on it.
Well, the other part of this, too, is also, you know, Trump, wittingly or unwittingly, because it's very hard to really label that one, the Secretary of State actually labeled the President of the United States an effing moron. So you kind of see where some of the cabinet's at. He has carried out a vast majority of his campaign promises. Now, the ones that he has not been able to carry out have been a direct result of inactivity and inaction on Capitol Hill. Of course, the major difference being is this last tax bill that they just shoved through. But where 2017 was bad in that respect, 2018 will be even more bad for the people that that tax bill starts to affect. And then there's only one way to undo that deficit, and they're going to have to go after the programs, the entitlement programs, the very programs that were put in place, starting with the Roosevelt administration, but more so put in place during Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, Medicare, Medicaid, and the food stamps, the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, SNAP as it's known. Those are Great Society programs that LBJ put in. And the things that the Republicans haven't necessarily worried about before was having the third rail of that. But then again, you do, in fact, have a large segment of the populace that probably doesn't quite understand what the negative impact will be until it directly affects them. That's where the difference will be made. People question at this point the legitimacy of this president. And my take on that is, you can always have the argument about the Electoral College later. Right now, you're faced with the fact that he is sitting in the Oval Office behind the Resolute desk. That means you need to deal with it. To Garrett's point about the voting thing, that's absolutely true. But the people that have been laying the groundwork to do something about this, and specifically as we move into the midterm elections, are going to have to be able to galvanize voters on issues that matter. We saw in Virginia a delegate run against an incumbent Republican and beat his pants. And this was a delegate that had been in office for a very long time. Of course, I'm speaking of Delegate Rome, the transgender delegate.
Although, right.
I'm kind of with everybody else on her. It's just she's the delegate. And she did it because she ran on the issues that mattered to her constituency. Principally, traffic, roads, nuts and bolts. That same philosophy is going to have to hold in the political spectrum. The only reason Judge Moore is not a United States senator is because black women voters kept him out of that seat. You want to know who's directly responsible? I'll tell you who's responsible. Black women voters. We got the final run of the numbers. 68% of white registered voters in the state of Alabama were okay voting for someone who had been accused of being a child molester. So what kept Moore out of office was the black women voters. But you can't necessarily always depend on every segment of every population in a lot of these red states, particularly in states that have gerrymandered seats. It's going to take a lot more than that. To Garrett's point, you're correct. The question becomes, how do you galvanize these people to get them out there? You have another issue that is confronting the Democratic Party right now. And that is the millennial voters and a lot of the voters that sat the 2016 election out. The reason they sat the election out was because of the piss-poor quality of the front-runner in the Democratic Party, in their eyes, okay? You have the same problem in the Congress right now with the leadership. Pelosi, Schumer, same thing, same problem. It's not exciting to these voters. They want their issues addressed. They're the ones that are galvanizing the movement. They've become the foot soldiers. You know, Bernie Sanders did a good job of starting it off, but Bernie Sanders is not a good choice to continue it. The baton or the torch, as JFK said in his inaugural address, has to be passed. And there's really where you're going to run into the larger issue. How do you convince these people, okay, when you have, in fact, a situation, particularly within the Democratic Party, where it has become so tone-deaf and clueless? The charges that the Democratic Party is catering to the elites is true. They've left their base, and that's not a good thing. They've got to get back to their roots. They've got to get back to the unions. They've got to get back to the Latino communities. They've got to get back into the black communities, and they've got to galvanize the action. You're not going to be able to do that when you have people like Senator Feinstein and Schumer and everybody else, has practically aged themselves out of office. And that is going to be an important consideration working into the next year. And issues are very much a part of it. The same old routine, the same old Democratic Party is not going to sail with these people. You saw one debacle after the other with the Democrats. You know, the interesting thing between the two parties is I'll give the Republicans and the conservatives credit for one thing. They're disciplined. They stay on message. But when you talk about progressives, socialists, Green Party, Democrats, and liberals, it's like herding cats in a parade. Good freaking what? And that's the type of thing that causes the most amount of problem. And that's also where you get voters, particularly the critical independents, throwing their hands up in the air and going, F this. What is it going to take? Now, we've seen the movement. We've seen the Me Too movement. We've seen the reaction to Charlottesville. We've seen the reaction by Black Lives Matter. In other words, the ground forces are there. The interest is there. But there is not a real sense of direction. If they want to take back Congress, are they going to take the Senate back? More than likely, the Democrats will get the Senate back. Are they going to take back the House? I predict they will not take back the House unless they are able to galvanize the independents and the millennials. And they damn sure better take a page out of a playbook of people like Delegate Romer in Virginia, okay, that specifically went after issues that voters care about. And that's really where it's going to amount. And this is across the board. This includes the LGBTQI community, the Latino community, the Black community. It's an all-in-one, and it's like the old poker expression, all-in. It has to be an all-in. You can no longer afford to have a party that is run by the elites that don't care. That way lies 2016, and that is why you end up with Donald J. Trump as the president of the United States, okay, period. Electoral college be damned. It literally became one of no. Well, you can't have that. Now, is it going to be caused by how much pain can be inflicted by the Republican Party in the interim? Yeah, I'd say so. But there's a greater overlying danger here that people also have to pay attention to. And that is that the United States has slipped so far down the rung in terms of global influences, in terms of respectability, not just because of Trump, but also because of its Congress. It does not help that you've got Trump sitting in the White House playing with nuclear fire with Korea. It does not help that you've got a Secretary of State that is decimating America's diplomatic corps. It does not help that you've got an American Secretary of the Interior and an American Administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency saying that global warming is a fantasy. It does not help when you have an ambassador to the United Nations, okay, sit there and play recess bully. If you vote against us for this ridiculous action, we're going to take your name and then we're going to take your money away. That's an even larger problem. So it is a combination of things. It's not just the one thing. 2017 has, in fact, been anus horribilis, and one of the reasons it has been anus horribilis is because the Democratic Party has lost its mind. It's not listening. The Republicans have been consistent the whole time. They've gotten behind a child molester. They've gotten behind a tax package that does nothing but help the wealthy screw the poor and is going to blow a hole in the deficit that's incredible. We're talking the iceberg that sank the bloody Titanic. But how do they do it? They stay on message. The Democrats, no. So 2018 is going to have to be the year where people need to take, again, I'll beat this to death, a page out of the playbook of the local races like in Palm Springs, California, where the entire bloody city council is LGBTQI, or Delegate Rome in Virginia. Years ago, Speaker Tip O'Neill told me, he had this mantra. Everybody that was a reporter, everybody that knew U.S. history has heard it. Tip said, all politics is local. And then he added, he said, and he leaned over. Now, I'll never forget this. As long as I live, he said, Brody, there's one more thing I want you to remember. politics is the art of persuasion and perception. And now, okay, some 35 years after that conversation with Speaker O'Neill, I can sit here and say that's exactly it. You've got a generation of people that are entirely ready to pick up the torch, pick up the baton, and move it forward and do something. But you're going to have to get the party hierarchy to get the hell out of the way and let them do it. You're going to have to convince the voters. You're going to have to convince the base. And part of that's going to have to be not by blowing the airwaves up with a bunch of political ads that nobody's going to pay attention to. The Republicans already have you there anyway because the special interest groups and, you know, Citizens United and all the corporate dark money has already pretty much killed that. But again, on a local level, you can still get around that obstacle, but you have to be on message. You have to be like Congressman Joseph Kennedy III of Massachusetts, Senator Kamala Harris of California, the Castro brothers of Texas. This is the type of messaging that has to be out there. Congressman David Cicilline of Rhode Island, we had on the show. That's what it's going to take. So, yes, 2017 was definitely and is horriblest, but I don't think it is all that insurmountable, but it is going to take a concerted effort. And the number one thing is the Democrats are going to have to realize, okay, that they're going to have to do what Kennedy said in his inaugural address, and they are going to have to be willing to sit down and pass the torch and let the younger generation move forward. I'm done. Rant over.
So Garrett had to leave us. He had another commitment he had to jet off to. So it's just you and I. I hear what you're saying. I think the really golden nugget there is to keep the politics local, because what worked in Alabama is not necessarily a strategy of different geographies. I think there's an opportunity on the House side in California. There are many of the districts out here that Hillary actually carried against Donald Trump. The Republican tax bill actually hurts even the Republican base out here. So I think there's a huge opportunity of a different disenfranchised group here. I absolutely agree that we need fresh vision, fresh ideas coming into the Democratic Party. I don't know how a Democrat in the current environment can even make a difference, quite frankly. I mean, we send them to Congress, but they have no power. I mean, the Republican tax bill went through without, you know, Democrats might not have even been in Washington at all. It went through, it got discussed, it got, you know, no Democrat got to see it. Certainly no Democrat gave input to it. So I hear what you're saying, but it's sort of a theoretical. I mean, it's not that the Democrats, you know, said the wrong thing. They weren't even allowed to talk. So, I think the strength of the party, and I would get very excited over, you know, some new blood coming in. I think it's time for that. But we've got to do the practical thing. We've got to win the Senate races. I think the epicenter is the Senate, not the House. I think the House is a want to have, but the Senate is a have to have. And it's the getting the Senate is the leverage point where everything else will revolve. I actually think that if the Senate went to the Democrats and Donald Trump, who is such an egomaniac that I don't think he cares as much about what the principles are that win as much as that he gets to win. And a Democratic Senate, I think we would suddenly see a Donald Trump that was doing things that were more progressive just so he could get a win. In other words, I think he would nominate Supreme Court justices and judicial candidates that could get through the Senate so he could look good, like he had done something. It's where I think some of his failings would work to a progressive advantage in a progressive sort of way. But there are some other things that have not happened in this country that I think we need to take pause over and look at seriously. One, I know you were saying, you know, we can look at the Electoral College later, but we need to look at the Electoral College. The Electoral College is this antiquated, ridiculous, mindless process that should have been gone years ago. And we are now at its mercy, and we have now seen a worst-case scenario play out through it. Now, nobody's going to do anything with the Republicans in control because it's not their best interest to do so. But we need to seriously, as a country, look at that and go, this is antiquated. It's ridiculous. It's based on slavery principles of 200 years ago. We have technology now that makes it completely unnecessary, and it isn't democratic. It isn't representative. The California vote was minimized due to the Electoral College, and that needs to take serious consideration. I mean, it is not an equal society right now. It is not an equal voting process right now. And we need people who are going to stand up and challenge that, you know, for the future. And that is one of the benefits of this horrible year, is seeing some failings in a system we have accepted for so long. And the Me Too movement is also part of that, because the Me Too movement is not calling out something that just happened. The Me Too movement is calling out something that we have lived with for decades, and it is now not acceptable. And that non-acceptability has come to the awareness of the public in a time when Donald Trump, the worst of the example of that old system, has been in power. And that's a good thing. I think that's a good thing. But what happens in the next year, next 2 years, next 3 years is going to be a result of people not being willing to sit for that status quo any longer. So I see it as a positive.
Well, I don't see it as a negative so much as I look at it in terms of an overview. One of the concerns that should probably be on everybody's mind is the degree to which Trump is still very much capable of dragging the United States into a conflict. He's shown that by his complete and utter disregard for convention, the decision to move the United States embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Virtually no one has put their embassy there, and there has been a reason for that. But again, you know, he's pandering to the American Christian right. And, you know, as far as they're concerned, this is great because, oh, it's the end of days and we need this. You know, well, that's fine. For the rest of us that don't believe in that hocus pocus, yeah, we're not good with that. Because what it does is it exasperates an already bad situation and makes it worse. The threats and the noise he's made, you know, to North Korea. Yeah, it's a never-ending parade. Now, I will grant you that there are, if you will, checks and balances on the executive in a way of you've got some folks that have a lot of experience and are probably acting as a buffer zone. And by that, I mean, of course, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, and, of course, John Kelly, the White House Chief of Staff, and then General McMasters. But you'll note that all three of those gentlemen are military. And that in and of itself is an uncomfortable thing. You know, the whole idea to having the structure of a civilian commander-in-chief and to have advisors that were civilians for oversight of the military was not to put yourself into a position that you would end up having a military-run government. And unfortunately, because of the very nature of the way that Trump operates, you know, it's a distinct possibility, particularly if you start talking a war scenario. It's not something that people should say it'll never happen. It very much could happen, and that really is another factor.
Right.
Yeah, I hear a lot of people talk about.
Wait, before you go on from that point, though, Brody, those things, I agree with you. Those are serious, serious things. I feel like, though, the Trump administration has owned the conversation around those. His MO is do something outrageous, own the conversation. So we're talking about Jerusalem. We're talking about North Korea. We watched the kind of his outlandish behavior around those things. The thing we're not talking about is our biggest nemesis has infiltrated our election and is continuing to do so, which is like that technological infiltration is really happening all around us. And because the Trump administration won't let us talk about it or is diverting our attention, that issue isn't being brought up. I mean, the last election was so close with Clinton that there is a possibility that some of those districts that swayed the election or swayed the numbers, they could actually not be legitimate. I mean, that could actually be a scenario. But nobody is looking at that. Nobody is bothering to take a look at that. And worse, nobody is doing anything to keep it from happening in the midterms or in other areas in the election. It's like we're being made incredibly susceptible to that foreign power, and our government isn't doing anything about it.
Well, I was going to mention, because that yet another, you know, pile of food on a plate, as it were. But, you know, with the investigation being run by Director Mueller, the indictments that has produced so far, the fact that, you know, it's not any kind of fiction at all whatsoever, that the Russian government had, in fact, had done something. It's just a matter of determining what exactly that something was. I don't think that the total scope and nature of it has, in fact, been determined. And it is very difficult when you have the administration screaming fake news and screaming that it's collusion and going out of their way to interfere. It does present a problem. And quite frankly, the White House is being aided and abetted by the Hill, because now you have Republicans that want to shut down Director Mueller's investigation. I think one of the reasons being, of course, for the Republicans at least, is that, you know, they may not like Trump. They may, in fact, despise the man, but that's the goose that laid the golden egg, because he's got the power to sign the stuff that they want to run through, which, again, this makes it critically important, of course, for 2018, that part of that power is blocked. And you're right, the Senate would be the way to do it. It would be very nice to get the House back, because articles of impeachment by your Constitution must originate in the House, and I would love to see a House Judiciary Committee impeach him. But the likelihood of that's probably not too good. But you're absolutely right. The entire scenario, and it is ongoing with the Russians. There was an article today in the New York Times talking about the fact that one of the hackers, the Russian hackers, had left behind digital footprints to follow in several different areas where they had infiltrated into the American IT and technology sector. And again, you know, these are things that have to be investigated, but it's very difficult to do when you've got a president at the same time that is trying to ruin the credibility of his own FBI with the American public. You know, he's taking shots at us in the press. He's delegitimizing, you know, the very machinations of the American government that would affect that change. It is very, very difficult. And that, too, is something that needs to be raised. There are members of the House, they're on both sides of the aisle, the Republican as well as Democrats, that are, in fact, raising these issues. But yeah, it's very difficult. And this is one of the things that I think is critically important, you know?
No, absolutely. Let me go to one thing you just mentioned, though, because I'm still I have a little discomfort, and I am all for Donald Trump being held accountable and all of that. Here's my fear about impeachment. Unless Mike Pence is completely indicted along with Donald Trump, Donald Trump being taken out of office and leaving a President Pence, who from just the LGBTQ perspective has been the major driver of all the horrific things that we've had to deal with this year, I see him as the safety net to keep us from not impeaching Trump. quite frankly.
Well,
I mean, I don't
I,
know
I,
that
I
he's
don't
better.
Necessarily disagree. Well, I don't necessarily disagree with that, but you know, if they were to take out both the president and the vice president, and the Democrats had in fact regained the majority of both houses of Congress, then we're talking a likelihood of a Pelosi presidency. So there is that consideration.
Well,
it's not as far-fetched as it sounds. Okay.
I wish that you know, wave your magic wand and make that happen. But it's let's face it, it's unprecedented. There's not that unprecedented isn't a keynote of this year, but never ever has the president and the vice president been under impeachment together, ever.
No, not at the same time. I mean, during the Nixon years,
we saw Agnew
first. And then we saw Nixon removed second, but there were two separate, you know, there was, I think, a space of time in between that. And, of course, Nixon self-removed. So, yeah, it would be a unique situation. Honestly, I don't know. I you know, my political instincts are telling me that the impeachment issue is a dead issue, and it's just simply a dead end. I think that the unfortunate reality is that the Democrats will regain the Senate. They're not going to regain the House, and everybody's going to be stuck with Trump until the term runs out in 2020. And the best case scenario is quite simply to keep him from getting reelected. And in hope in the meantime that a Democratic Senate can at least mitigate and contain some of the damage that he is inflicting on the government of the United States. And by that, I also mean high-ranking members of his administration, such as Secretary DeVos, such as EPA Administrator Pruitt, such as HUD Secretary Carson, such as even the Secretary of State, who I mentioned earlier in the show, who's completely decimated the diplomatic corps. So, and then, of course, the Interior Secretary, and, well, you know, you can go on. We could do probably two or three more shows on just the damage these people have done in less than a year.
Right.
Consider they have not even been in power a year yet.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. The thing about the Senate, though, if we got the Senate, and this is where I think it's a two-step, is that we would get the Senate, but to your point about local politics, that if we have progressive people getting involved, people who wouldn't have run otherwise, that they're mad enough they want to be involved in the system, and we get an influx at that local level, I think that would be a positive. And I would also, one thing, you know, you were ranting against the Democratic power guard that's in. The other side of that, too, though, I think, is the progressive movements need to be a little more inclusive with each other. And I'm talking about the new progressives. You know, it's like there's just this huge tone of, if you're not one of us, whatever our special group is, you don't count. And that is not going to fly. That is a cancer that is waiting to happen. So, Brody, we've got literally a minute and a half here. I'm going to let you take us out, my friend. You tell us in that minute and a half what point we haven't covered for 2017 that we need to talk about.
It's not over yet. So just everybody keep their fingers crossed until 12:01 Monday, please. I really don't have much more to add. I just would like to say that the most important thing for those of you that are listening to this program and those of you that read what myself and my fellow journalists write and report on is that be assured that the vast majority of us are doing it for you. We are your advocates. We are reporting these stories. These are for you. And that the administration's claim of fake news is completely false. That's not true. There are a lot of good reporters out there. There are a lot of good people out there. And, you know, we're just going to redouble our efforts because now is a critical time, and we need that. So on behalf of myself and my staff, I want to thank you, Rob, for a pretty good 2017, and I look forward to 2018.
Yep, we're going to have fun. So I want to thank you all for listening to Rated LGBT Radio. We will be back here next week in 2018, so you get to hear our show then. Also, listen to Out in Santa Cruz on www.ksco.com, Saturday night, 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern time. We have a good time there, and we will have a best of playing this Saturday, so you'll hear our recorded, previous recorded show then. And come back next week. We will have something fantastic, mind-blowing, and wonderful for you here.